Welcome back to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway, coming at you from my new, my new spot. I've got a new seating arrangement. I had this spare room in my house. It's a two-bedroom house, my house. It's a tiny little house, but it does have two bedrooms, and I'm only one person, so this second bedroom has just sort of been a spare space for a while. And I have my computer set up out in this kind of entry hall because for heating reasons, there's no door that can block off the entry hall. So if the heat is on, that place is being warmed up no matter what. Whereas this spare room, if I closed the door, it meant the rest of the house would warm up quicker, right? So this was just the cold room. It was always too cold in here to do anything. But I thought the main reason it was cold is because there's a big window in this room and it didn't have a curtain. And a lot of cold air comes in through that window. And also a lot of sort of noise from outside, rose noise. I thought if I can get a nice curtain... I need to blow my nose. Did I tell you guys I'm sick? I probably did. Should I cut out the sound of me blowing my nose? Nah, it wasn't too loud. Anyway, a curtain. That's all I needed. For all this time I've been in this house is a curtain. And I just never did it. And I went and got a curtain today. And now I've set up my computer in here and I've made it into like a little office. And it's very cozy. But as I'm sitting here podcasting in my new space, in my desk, which is chalked between two bookcases, there's like a nice little reverb to this spot. Also, in moving my computer and resetting up my equipment, you guys, I don't know if you guys remember, but months ago, I'm going to say like 3 months ago, my computer randomly started getting a hum. And I couldn't figure out why it was humming. It was a grounding problem. For literally the last 3 months, I reckon, I've been podcasting with one hand touching my keyboard because that closed the grounding loop. And then you couldn't hear the hum. So in order to get rid of the hum, the only thing I could do was touch my hand to the keyboard. And I couldn't figure out why. In moving the equipment, I thought, I'll plug in the other microphone because I've actually got three identical microphones. They're Behringer C1s, condenser microphones. They're very good, cheap microphone. If you think this podcast sounds good, it's recorded on a $70 microphone, Australian dollars, which is about 50 American dollars. Which just goes to show you don't need an expensive mic. Anyway, I swapped over to one of the other ones, and it turns out the other one that I'd been using was the problem. It was the microphone that was the problem. It must have become faulty at some point. I was just saying, for a cheap microphone, they're really good, and they are really good, but I suppose that's why they're cheap, because they might be prone to having faults after a while. Maybe. Grounding problems. Anyway, I fixed that problem, so I don't, like, out of habit, I keep resting my hand on the keyboard to close the grounding loop, but I don't have to anymore. And it's like I've just got a new hand. It's like I've just got a new podcasting hand. Also, the beverage of choice tonight is a really nice hot chocolate, which I'm sipping on. It's beautiful. It's the middle of winter here in Australia, if you didn't know that, down under in the southern hemisphere. So, hence me being sick and always having a warm beverage. Enough talking nonsense. This is like 5 minutes before we've even gotten into the podcast. Today we're talking about The Brothers Karamazov, Book 12, Chapter 8. My question was capital Z followed by two smaller Zs, which is the universal symbol of snoring. Zzz. That was my question. the chapter just... I don't know. These chapters are killing me. Um... Swim said the mama fishy said, okay, I'm not afraid, ashamed to admit that I watch reality TV, also sitcoms. I absolutely hate recap episodes. We are stuck in a 19th century version of a recap episode, or of recap episodes. You can dress up a pig, you can try to make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. I am on team Z. Soma Stars said, team Z all the way. I'm glad I'm not the only one snoring through this book. Thank you guys for joining team Z. Techrific said, by the way, Ander, your direct episode links for the last 4 to 5 podcasts are broken. Let me just double check that for you real quick. Oh, so it is. So it is. Well, okay. In future, oh, you've got the link there. ayearofwarandpeace.podbean.com. You can actually just type in thehemingwaylist.com and that'll get you to the podcast as well. So if you're just looking for the latest episode, thehemingwaylist.com, and it'll be right at the top of the page, whatever's the newest one. But I'll fix that link in from today on. What I usually do is just tinker with the numbers in the link, rather than copy and paste the link every time. I just update the couple of digits that will update, but sometimes I suppose I get it wrong, and then once I've got it wrong once, I keep getting it wrong. Anyway, doesn't matter, I'll fix that. Thanks for letting me know, Techrific. Techrific also said, the prosecutor meticulously pulverizes the idea of Smerdyakov as the murderer. Everything that could be construed as evidence against Smurdy is effectively and plausibly explained. The idiocy of Mitch's letter to Katerina hits us with full force when Ippolit uses the exact wording and circumstances to show why Fyodor was killed when he was. Mitcher had said in that letter that he'd kill Fyodor only if Ivan was absent. Could Smerdyakov have known of the exact wording of the letter, or is only one of the many coincidences that conspired to make the case against Mitcher so compelling? Dostoevsky shows great insight into, on the one hand, very mysterious and on the other hand, very ordinary circumstances and events that look so damning after the fact. Life can be very strange and absurd sometimes, and in court cases in particular, that is set in sharp relief to our beliefs, feelings, and normative thinking about how it's supposed to be. We sometimes expect life to make much more sense than it really does. Only humans can oppose the chaos of life. What little order and calm we achieve in life is hard fought for, psychologically and physically. We are all both alone and together in this. It's a riddle wrapped in a mystery, inside an enigma, as Winston Churchill said about Russia. Is that a Winston Churchill quote? I never knew where that church was, that church, where that quote was from. A riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. I thought it was like from The Simpsons or something. God, I'm dumb. I am a Norwegian responded to my question from yesterday's episode. Did you watch The Bodyguard? Haha, I ended up not liking that. I empathize with the short attention span towards new shows. Once upon a time, I watched everything new. Now I just watch the cream of the crop. I will say that Chernobyl was incredible throughout. Some of the best television I have ever seen. Wow, okay. I've heard a lot of good things about Chernobyl. And, I should watch it. When I saw it come up, I thought, I already sort of know what happened in Chernobyl to an extent. You know, I know of that incident. So I didn't really think there'd be much to it that would compel me. You know, like watching a documentary about something you sort of are already a bit across. But it seems, from all the fuss I've heard about it, that it must be really good. Didn't like Bodyguard. I thought it was really cool, but I suppose, yeah, everyone's got different tastes, hey. But you must agree, though, I reckon. Well, maybe you don't have to agree, but that opening where he's on the train, it's in the first couple of minutes of the series. It starts with him on a train and he opens up the door to go to the bathroom and there's a woman with a strapped on bomb vest holding the button, the kill switch to blow up the train. And he happens to be a bomb squad, ex-military bomb, what is he? Like a bomb negotiator. That's probably not the word. And just straight up, he just straight away starts to try to talk this lady out of pressing this button. And she's like sweating and she's about to press the button. He's like, no, please don't do that. Please don't do that. And he keeps talking to her. It's so tense. And this is like, you're like 2 minutes into the show at this point and you're like hooked. Yeah, I just thought that was really, really good start to the show. I kind of will admit, though, if there was a season two of it, I probably wouldn't watch it. You know what I mean? It just feels like, I don't know. I don't think I'd watch a season two of it. But season one, yeah. I don't know. It just hit the ground running and maybe it just hooked me really quickly. continuing. Responding to my question. Haha, I bet you're looking forward to the defense's turn to speak. I think these speeches might just be the rest of the book. Oh, God. So the defense is going to talk next. We've still got about 60 pages left in this book or something like that. Hang on, let me have a quick look. Oh, I don't have the book open. I'm glad I went to have a look then because I've got to open up the book, which can take a couple of minutes to load. While that loads... Yeah, we've got quite a bit of book to go, really. We've still got a good, 10% of the book left, I would say, something around that. So, we're not quite there yet. And if it's all just speeches, then I might just die instead. What's that awesome Albert Camus quote? Albert Camus. He says, should we get coffee or should we just kill ourselves? Or something like that. I'm actually searching it right now. Albert Camus. I think it's from The Outsider. He says, should I kill myself or have a cup of coffee? Which I don't think was supposed to be funny, but God, that's brilliant. And also, great reference in Sex in the City. Sex in the City... referenced that Albert Camus quote, which I just thought was so cool. They're in the cafe and she says, should we get another cup of coffee or kill ourselves? I know the feeling. I really do. Well, not really, but, you know, I know the sentiment. Oh, God. Okay. What's happening here? Microsoft Word. Oh, because I had to move my computer, I had to, like, actually shut it down for once, and I don't do that often, so it's just reloading up everything. I should have reloaded all this while I ranted at you for 5 minutes at the start of the episode. Okay. Here we really start to see that Ippolit is not a Dosto self-insert, says I Am Norwegian. Ippolit shares some of his brilliant insight into the field of psychology. He argues that epilepsy makes people prone to all-pervading and, of course, morbid self-recrimination. He goes on to say that they are tormented by guilt, often for no reason at all. Maybe this was the medical consensus at the time, but it's unlikely that this is how Dosto viewed epilepsy, given that he himself had it. Oh, I didn't know that. Later, Ippolit argues that Dmitri jumped down from the fence to check on Grigory, simply to see that the only witness was dead. Only other motive would have been unnatural. He is wrong again. I will say that Ippolit is a great lawyer. I'm glad I'm not one of the jurors. I would have been sending an innocent man to his death or Siberia. Uncle Jossel Mayer said the prosecutor discredited the theory that blames Smerdyakov as the author of Fyodor's murder. He describes Smerdy as a man with low intelligence and enough lack of will to plot murder and carry it out. Actually, he described him as a victim of physical and psychological abuse by the Karamazov family, and he ended his exposition telling the audience how the facts exhibit Dmitri as the only murderer of his father. Last thoughts. The analysis of Bakhtin and this theory of polyphony says that in Dostoevsky's novels coexist many characters with different perspectives and voices who are not subordinate to the author's point of view. That quality gives realism and aesthetics complexity to his stories. I think we are going to see different perspectives here. Maybe what Dosto wants to show us is how flawed and absurd is the way the legal system works. To accomplish that, we need to know the contrasting reasons of the prosecutor and the defense attorney over facts that we already know the truth. Last thoughts. I cannot help to see that Dosto put the chapters of The Lawyer next to the one of the devil. I think he knew something. Sorry for the bad joke. Oh, there we go. Well, there we go, indeed. Let me just see how this is. Oh, please give me a little jump forward button. Oh, it's giving me the jump forward button. Nice. I didn't have to scroll down 650 pages. It jumped me forward to the page I needed. Good old Microsoft Word. Okay, there's a few responses there. I'm not going to read them. Ooh. Yeah. No, I'm not going to read them. Sorry, they're just little backs and forths of people agreeing, so they're not really going to change the point of what we're saying. Sorry, I'm very distracted tonight because I haven't loaded my pages. And you know how I get when I don't load my pages. Chapter 9 is called The Galloping Troika, The End of the Prosecutor's Speech. It's long. It's probably boring. It goes for 8 pages. Or 9. I think it goes for 9 pages. And let's read it. And I apologize in advance for how dreary this will be. It goes forever. Oh my God. Ippolit Kirillovich had chosen the historical method of exposition beloved by all nervous orators who find it, in its limitation, a check on their own eager rhetoric. At this moment in his speech, he went off into a dissertation on Grushenka's first lover and brought forward several interesting thoughts on this theme. Karamazov, who had been frantically jealous of everyone, collapsed, so to speak, and effaced himself at once before this first lover. What makes it all the more strange is that he seems to have hardly thought of this formidable rival. But he looked upon him as a remote danger, and Karamazov always lives in the present. Possibly he regarded him as a fiction, but this wounded heart grasped instantly that the woman had been concealing this new rival and deceiving him because he was anything but a fiction to her, because he was the one hope of her life. Grasping this instantly, he resigned himself. Gentlemen of the jury, I cannot help dwelling on this unexpected trait in the prisoner's character. He suddenly evinces an irresistible desire for justice, a respect for women, and a recognition of her right to love. And all this is at the very moment when he had stained his hands with his father's blood for her sake. It is true that the blood he had shed was already crying out for vengeance, for after having ruined his soul and his life in this world, he was forced to ask himself at that same instant what he was and what he would be now to her. To that same instant, what he was and what he could be now to her, to that it being dearer to him than his own soul in comparison with that former lover. I don't know what this sentence is saying. Let me start that again. It starts about 15 minutes ago. It is true that the blood he had shed was already crying out for vengeance, for after having ruined his soul and his life in this world, he was forced to ask himself at that same instant what he was and what he could be now to her, to that being dearer to him than his own soul in comparison with that former lover who had returned penitent with new love to the woman he had once betrayed with honourable offers with the promise of a reformed and happy life. And he, luckless man, what could be given her now? What could he offer? That is one of the worst sentences I've ever read. That is one of the worst sentences I have ever read. That is the clumsiest, clunkiest piece of trash. Oh, Karamazov felt all this. knew that all ways were barred to him by his crime and that he was a criminal under sentence and not a man with life before him. This thought crushed him, and so he instantly flew to one frantic plan, which to a man of Karamazov's character must have appeared to one inevitable way out of his terrible position. That way out was suicide. He ran for the pistols he had left in pledge with his friend Perhotin. And on the way, as he ran, he pulled out his pocket the money, for the sake of which he had stained his hands with his father's gore. Oh, now he needed money more than ever. Karamazov would die, Karamazov would shoot himself, and it should be remembered. To be sure, he was a poet, and had burnt the candle at both ends of all his life. To her, and there, oh, there, I will give a feast to the whole world, such as never was before, that will be remembered and talked of long after. In the midst of shouts of wild merriment, reckless gypsy songs and dances, I shall raise the glass and drink to the women I adore and her new-found happiness. And then, on the spot, at her feet, I shall dash out all my brains before her and punish myself. She will remember Mitya Karamazov sometimes. She will see how Mitya loved her. She will feel for Mitya! Exclamation point. Here we see in excess a love of effect, a romantic despair and sentimentality, and a wild recklessness of the Karamazovs. Yes, but there is something else, gentlemen of the jury, something that cries out in the soul, throbs incessantly in the mind, and poisons the heart unto death. That something is conscience, gentlemen of the jury. It is judgment, its terrible torments. The pistol will settle everything, and the pistol is the only way out. Bit beyond, I don't know whether Karamazov wondered at that moment what lies beyond. Whether Karamazov could, like Hamlet, wonder what lies beyond. No, gentlemen of the jury, they have their Hamlets. But we still have our Karamazovs. Here Ippolit Kirillovich drew a minute picture of Mitch's preparations. The scene at Perhotin's, at the shop with the drivers. He quoted numerous words and actions, confirmed by witnesses, and the picture made a terrible impression on the audience. The guilt of this harassed and desperate man stood out clear and convincing when the facts were brought together. What need had he of precaution? Two or three times he almost confessed, hinted at, all but spoke out. Then followed the evidence given by witnesses. He cried out to the peasant who drove him, "Do you know you are driving a murderer?" But it was impossible for him to speak out. He had to get to Mokroe, and there to finish his romance. But what was awaiting the luckless man almost from the first minute at Mokroe? He saw that his invincible rival was perhaps by no means so invincible, that the toast to their new-found happiness was not desired and would not be acceptable. But you know the facts, gentlemen of the jury, from the preliminary inquiry. Karamazov's triumph over his rival was complete, and his soul passed into quite a new phase, perhaps the most terrible phase through which his soul has passed, or will pass. One may say with certainty, gentlemen of the jury, the prosecutor continued, that outraged nature and the criminal heart bring their own vengeance more completely than any earthly justice. What's more, justice and punishment on earth positively alleviate the punishment of nature and are indeed essential to the soul of the criminal at such moments as its salvation from despair. Holy mackerel, salvation from despair. For I cannot imagine the horror and moral suffering of Karamazov when he learnt that she loved him, for his sake she had rejected her first lover, that she was summoning him, Mitya, to a new life, that she was promising him happiness. And when? When everything was over for him and nothing was possible. By the way, I will note in parenthesis a point of importance for the light it throws on the prisoner's position at the moment. This woman, this love of his, had been, till the last moment, till the very last, very instant of his arrest, a being unattainable, passionately desired by him, but unattainable. Yet why did he not shoot himself then? Why did he relinquish his design and even forget where his pistol was? It was just that passionate desire for love and the hope of satisfying it that restrained him. Throughout their revels, he kept close to his adored mistress, who was at the banquet with him, and was more charming and fascinating to him than ever. He did not leave her side, abasing himself in his homage before her. His passion might well for a moment stifle not only the fear of arrest, but even the torments of conscience. For a moment, oh, only for a moment, I can picture the state of mind of the criminal, hopelessly enslaved by these influences. First, the influence of drink, of noise and excitement, of the thud of the dance and the scream of the song, and her, flushed with wine, singing and dancing and laughing to him. Secondly, the hope in the background that the fatal end might still be far off, that not till next morning, at least, they would come and take him. So he had a few hours, and that's much, very much. In a few hours, one can think of many things. I imagine that he felt something like what criminals feel when they are being taken to the scaffold. They have another long, 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 long street to pass down before, and at walking pace past thousands of people. Then there will be a turning into another street, and only at the end of that street, the dread place of execution. I fancy that at the beginning of this journey, the condemned man, sitting in his shameful cart, must feel that he has infinite life still before him. The houses recede, the cart moves on. Oh, that's nothing. It's still far to the turning into the second street, and he still looks boldly to the right and to the left at the thousands of callously curious people with their eyes fixed upon him, and he still fancies that he is just such a man as they. But now this turning comes to the next street. Oh, that's nothing, nothing. There's still a whole street before him, and however many houses have been passed, he will still think there are many left. And so, to the very end, to the very scaffold. This, I imagine, how it was with Karamazov then. They've not had time yet, he must have thought. I may still find some way out. Oh, there's still time to make some plan of defence. And now. She is so fascinating. His soul was full of confusion and dread, and he managed however to put aside half his money and hide it somewhere. I cannot otherwise explain the disappearance of quite half of the 3,000 he had just taken from his father's pillow. He had been in Mogrory more than once. He had caroused there for 2 days together already. He knew the old big house with its passages and outbuildings. I imagine that part of the money was hidden in that house not long before the arrest, in some crevice under the floor, in some corner under the roof. With what object, I shall be asked. Why, the catastrophe may take place at once. Of course, he hadn't yet considered how to meet it. He hadn't the time. His head was throbbing and his heart was with her. But money was indispensable in any case. With money, a man is always a man. Perhaps such foresight or at such a moment may strike you as unnatural. But he assures us himself that a month before, at a critical and exciting moment, he had halved his money and sewn it up in a little bag. And though that was not true, as we shall prove directly, it shows the idea was a familiar one to Karamazov. He had contemplated it. What's more, when he declared at the inquiry that he had put 1,500 rubles in a bag which never existed, he may have invented that little bag on the inspiration of the moment, because he had 2 hours before dividing his money and hidden half of it at Mokroi till morning. In case of emergency, simply not to have it on himself, two extremes, gentlemen of the jury, remember that Karamazov can contemplate two extremes, and both at once. We have looked in the house, but we haven't found the money. It may still be there, or it may have disappeared next day and be in the prisoner's hands now. In any case, he was at her side, on his knees before her. She was lying on the bed. He had his hands stretched out to her, and he had so entirely forgotten everything that he did not even hear the men coming to arrest him. He hadn't time to prepare any line of defence in his mind. He was caught unawares and confronted with the judges and arbiters of his destiny. Gentlemen of the jury, there are moments in the execution of our duties when it is terrible for us to face a man, terrible on his account too. The moment of contemplating that animal fear, when the criminal sees that all is lost, but still struggles, still means some struggle, the moments even when every instinct of self-preservation rises up in him at once, and he looks at you with questioning eyes and suffering eyes, studies you, your face, your thoughts, uncertain on which side you will strike. And his distracted mind frames thousands of plans in an instant, but he is still afraid to speak, afraid of giving himself away. This purgatory of the spirit, this animal thirst for self-preservation, these humiliating moments of the human soul are awful and sometimes arouse sorrow and compassion for the criminal, even in the lawyer. And this was what we all witnessed then. At first he was thunderstruck. Thunderstruck! And in his terror dropped some very compromising phrases.
Blood!
I deserved it. But he quickly restrained himself. He had not prepared what he was to say, what answer he was to make. He had nothing but a bare denial already. I am not guilty of my father's death. That was his fence for the moment, and behind it he hoped to throw up a barricade of some sort. His first compromising exclamations he hastened to explain by declaring that he was responsible for the death of his servant Grigory only. Of that bloodshed I am guilty. But who has killed my father, gentlemen? Who has killed him? Who can have killed him if not I? Do you hear? He asked us that. Us, who had come to ask him that question, do you hear that uttered with such premature haste, if not I, the animal cunning, the naivete of Karamazov, impatience of it? I didn't kill him. You mustn't think I did. I've wanted to kill him, gentlemen. I've wanted to kill him, he hastens to admit. He was in a hurry, in a terrible hurry. But still, I am not guilty. It is not I who murdered him. He concedes to us that he wanted to murder him, as though to say, you can see for yourselves how truthful I am. So you'll believe all the sooner that I didn't murder him. Oh, in such cases, the criminal is often amazingly shallow and credulous. At that point, one of the lawyers asked him, as if it were incidentally, the most simple question. Wasn't it Smerdyakov killed him? Then, as we expected, he was horribly angry at our having anticipated him and caught him unawares. Before he had time to pave the way to choose and snatch the moment when it would be most natural to bring Smerdyakov's name, he rushed at once to the other extreme, as he always does, and began to assure us that Smerdyakov could not have killed him, was not capable of it. But don't believe him, that was only his cunning. He didn't really give up the idea of Smerdyakov. On the contrary, he meant to bring up him even forward again further, for indeed he had no one else to bring forward. But he would do the latter, because, for the moment, that line was spoiled for him. He would bring him forward perhaps next day, or even a few days later, choosing an opportunity to carry it out to us. You know, I was more sceptical about Smerdyakov than you. You remember that yourselves, but I know. I am convinced. He killed him. He must have done. And for the present, he falls back upon a gloomy and irritable denial. Impatience and anger prompted him, however, to the most inept and incredible explanation of how he looked into his father's window and how he respectfully withdrew. The worst of it was that he was unaware of the position of affairs, of the evidence given by Grigory. We proceeded to search him. The search angered him, but encouraged him. The whole 3,000 had not been found on him, only half of it, and no doubt only at that moment of angry silence the fiction of the little bag first occurred to him. No doubt he was conscious himself of the improbability of the story and strove painfully to make it sound more likely, to weave it into our romance that would sound plausible. In such cases, the first duty, the chief task of the investigating lawyers is to prevent the criminal being prepared to pounce upon him unexpectedly, so that he may blurt out his cherished ideas in all their simplicity, improbability, and inconsistency. The criminal can only be made to speak by the sudden and apparent incidental communication of some new fact, of some circumstance of great importance in the case, of which he had no previous idea and could not have foreseen. He had such a fact in readiness that was Grigory's evidence about the open door through which the prisoner had run out. He had completely forgotten about that door and had not even suspected that Grigory could have seen it. The effect of it was amazing. He leapt up and shouted to us, "Then Smerdyakov murdered him. It was Smerdyakov!" And so betrayed the basis of the defence he was keeping back, and betrayed in the its impossible probable shape. What? And betrayed in its most improbable shape, for Smerdyakov could only have committed the murder after he had knocked Grigory down and run away. When he told him that Grigory saw the door, he was open before he fell down, and he heard Smerdyakov behind the screen as he came out of his bedroom. Karamazov was positively crushed. My esteemed and witty colleagues, Nikolai Parfenovich, told me afterwards that he was almost moved to tears at the sight of him. And, to improve matters, the prisoner hastened to tell us about the much-talked-of little bag. So be it. You shall hear this romance. Gentlemen of the jury, I have told you already why I consider the romance not only an absurdity, but the most improbable invention that I've ever brought across in the circumstances. If only tried for a bet to invent the most unlikely story, one could hardly find anything more incredible. The worst of such stories is that the triumphant romances can always be put to confusion and crushed by the very details in which real life is so rich, and which these unhappy and involuntary storytellers neglect as insignificant trifles. Oh, they have no thought to spare for such details. Their minds are concentrated on their grand invention as a whole, and fancy anyone daring to pull up them for a trifle. But that's how they are caught. The prisoners was asked the question, "Where did you get the stuff for your little bag, and who made it for you?" "I made it myself." "And where did you get the linen?" The prisoner was positively offended. He thought it almost insulting to him to ask him such a trivial question, and would you believe it, his resentment was genuine. "But they are all like that. I tore it off my shirt." "Then we shall find that shirt among your linen tomorrow, with a piece of torn off. And only fancy, gentlemen of the jury, if we really had found that torn shirt, and how could we have failed to find it in his chest of drawers or trunk? That would have been a fact, a material fact, in support of his statement. But he was incapable of that reflection. I don't remember. It may have been off my shirt. I sewed it up in one of my landlady's caps." "What sort of a cap?" "It was an old cotton rag of hers lying about. And do you remember that clearly?" "No, I don't." "And was he angry?" "Very angry. And yet imagine not remembering it." "At the most terrible moments of a man's life, the instance when he is being led to the execution, he remembers just such trifles. He will forget anything but some green roof that has flashed past him on the road, or a jack or a door across the road that he will remember. He concealed the making of that little bag from his household, and he must remember it. His humiliating fear that someone might come in and find him with a needle in hand. How at the slightest sound he slipped behind the screen. There is a screen in his lodgings. But, gentlemen of the jury, why did I tell you all this? All these details, all these trifles?" "Cried Ippolit Kirillovich suddenly. "Just because the prisoner still persists in these absurdities to this moment. He has not explained anything since that fatal night 2 months ago. He has not added one actual illuminating fact to his former fantastic statements. All those are trivialities. You must believe it on my honour. Oh, we are glad to believe it. We are eager to believe it. Even if only on his word of honour. Are we jackals thirsting for human blood? Show us a single fact in the prisoner's favour and we shall rejoice. But let it be a substantial real fact and not a conclusion drawn from the prisoner's expression by his own brother. Or that when he beat himself on the breast, he must have meant to point to the little bag in the darkness too. We shall rejoice at the new fact. We shall be the first to repudiate and our charge. We shall hasten to repudiate it. But now justice cries out, and we persist. We cannot repudiate anything. Ippolit Kirillovich passed to his final peroration. He looked as though he was in a fever. He spoke of the blood that cried for vengeance. The blood of the father murdered by his son with the base motive of robbery. He pointed to the tragic and glaring consistency of the facts. And whatever you hear from the talented and celebrated counsel for the defence, Ippolit Kirillovich could not resist adding, whatever eloquent and touching appeals may be made to your sensibilities, remember that at this moment you are in a temple of justice. Remember that you are the champions of our justice, the champions of our holy Russia, of her principles, her family, everything that she holds sacred. Yes, you represent Russia here at this moment, and your verdict will be heard not in this hall only, but will re-echo throughout the whole of Russia. And all Russia will hear you as her champions and her judges, and she will be encouraged or disheartened by your verdict. Do not disappoint Russia and her expectations. Our fatal Troika dashes on in her headlong flight, perhaps to destruction, and in all Russia for long past men have stretched out imploring hands and called a halt to its furious, reckless course. And if other nations stand aside from that Troika, that may be, not from respect, as the poet would fain believe, but simply from disgust, and well it is that they stand aside, but maybe they will cease one day to do so, and will form a firm wall confronting the hurrying apparition, and will check the frenzied rush of our lawlessness for the sake of their own safety, enlightenment, and civilization. Already we have heard voices of alarm from Europe. They already begin to sound. Do not tempt them. Do not heap up their growing hatred by a sentence justifying the murder of a father by his son. Though Ippolit was genuinely moved, he wound up his speech with a rhetorical appeal. And the effect produced by him was extraordinary. When he had finished his speech, he went out hurriedly and, as I have mentioned before, almost fainted in the adjoining room. There was no applause in the court, but serious persons were pleased. The ladies were not so well satisfied, though even they were pleased with his eloquence, especially as they had no apprehensions as to the upshot of the trial and had full trust in Fetyukovich. He will speak at last, and of course carry all before him. Everyone looked at Mitya. He sat silently through the whole of the prosecutor's speech, clenching his teeth with his hands clasped and his head bowed. Only from time to time he raised his head and listened, especially from Grushenka, when Grushenka was spoken of. When the prosecutor mentioned Rakitin's opinion of her, a smile of contempt and anger passed over his face, and he murmured, rather audibly, "The Bernards." When Ippolit Kirillovich described how he had questioned and tortured him at Mokroe, Mitya raised his head and listened with intense curiosity. At one point he seemed about to jump up and cry out, but controlled himself and only shrugged his shoulders disdainfully. People talked afterwards, at the end of the speech, of the prosecutor's feat in examining the prisoner of Mokroe, and jeered at Ippolit Kirillovich. "The man could not resist boasting of his cleverness," they said. That's what they said. The man could not resist, but they said. The court was adjourned, but only for a short interval, a quarter of an hour or 20 minutes at most. There was a hum of conversation and exclamations in the audience. I remember some of them. A weighty speech, a gentleman in one group observed gravely. "He brought in too much psychology," said another voice, "but it was all true, the absolute truth. Yes, he is first rate at it. He summed it all up." "Yes, he summed us up too," chimed in another voice. "Do you remember at the beginning of his speech making out we were all like Fyodor Pavlovich? And at the end too, but that was all rot and obscure too. He was a little too much carried away. It's unjust, it's unjust." "No, it was smartly done anyway. He's had long to wait, but he's had his way, ha ha." "What will the counsel for the defence say?" In another group I heard, "He had no business to make a thrust at the Petersburg man like that, appealing to your sensibilities. Do you remember?" "Yes, that was awkward of him." "Yes, it was too great a hurry." "He's a nervous man." "We laugh, but what about must the prisoner be feeling?" "Yes, what must it be for Mitya?" In a third group, What lady is that, the fat one, with a lorgnette sitting at the end? She is a general's wife, divorced, I know her. That's why she has the lorgnette. She is not good for much. Oh no, she is a piquant little woman. Two places beyond her, there is a little fair woman. She is prettier. They caught him smartly at Mock Rowey, didn't they, hey? Oh, it was smart enough. We've heard it before. How often he has told the story at people's houses. And he couldn't resist doing it now. That's vanity. He is a man with a grievance, he. Yes, and quick to take offence. And there was too much rhetoric. Such long sentences. Yes, he tries to alarm us. He kept trying to alarm us. Do you remember about the Troika? Something about they have Hamlets, but we have so far only Karamazovs. That was cleverly said. That was to propitiate the liberals. He is afraid of them.
Yes, and he is afraid of the lawyer too.
Yes, what will Fetyukovich say? Whatever he says, he won't get round our peasants. Don't you think so?
A fourth group said,
what he said about the Troika was good, that piece about other nations.
And that was true, what he said about the other nations not standing it.
What do you mean?
Why, in English Parliament, a member got up last week and, speaking about the nihilists, asked the Ministry whether it was not high time to intervene to educate this barbarous people. Hippolyte was thinking of him. I know he was. He was talking about that last week.
Not an easy job.
Not an easy job? Why not?
Why, we'd shut up Kronstadt and not let them have any corn. Where would they get it?
In America. They get it from America now.
Nonsense.
But the bell rang. All rushed to their places. Fetyukovich mounted the tribune. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. If you're still alive, you haven't killed yourself, have your say about this chapter over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.